This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Yeah, the hair and the lankiness. I don't know.
I'm not asking you to kiss the guy. I'm just saying, like, do you find his songs funny?
Oh, funny. I mean, I guess in some elementary school way, right?
Oh, wow. What does Gadfly say?
This is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Weird Al of Education Policy, Dara Z. Handler.
How did I know you were going to say that?
I love these new songs that Weird Al is out with. I have to admit, I'm a big Weird Al fan. I mean, go figure. Wordplay, parody, singing, he's got it all. Do you have a favorite Weird Al song?
I don't find him particularly funny or entertaining.
What? Are you serious?
Yeah. And this is not just now. This has been since whatever the, you know, in the 90s and Eat It and
White and Nerdy.
Right? What? No, see, I think that he's clever, but
right?
It's not really my cup of tea. Maybe for the same reason that I can't stand karaoke and I really don't like cover bands either.
Oh, Tara, I mean, what?
And
is
I hate
this?
Fun. I hate fun,
oh,
Mike.
There it is. I mean, you have now alienated most of our listeners, all right, with all of that. What you know?
I hate fun. No,
you do. You are somebody who likes to go run for fun. I mean, that right there is a.
I'd rather listen to the original. And if that means a DJ instead of a cover band at a party, then fine.
Listen to Weird Al because of the music. You listen because of the funny lyrics.
Okay.
Just eat it. Just eat it. That is my favorite, I have to say. Because I never quite understood the original lyrics on that one. Just beat it. But anyways, but just eat it. That was a great song.
It's funny. I'm really sorry.
You don't like puns either, do you?
I knew you were. It's because I hate fun and I'm not funny.
I knew you were going to come in and ask me. The ironic thing is, Pamela, is that, and I hope this is irony, but maybe it's not, but is that Dara's actually very good at our April Fool's Day gadfly effort. She comes up with some of the best ideas. You are funny.
Because I'm always the straight man. I'm the last with the joke. I'll think of a punchline like 2 hours after the joke. So I can do the straight stuff, but I'm just not very clever, Mike.
All
it's
right.
True.
Well, if you haven't yet, check out Weird Al's new song, Word Crimes. It's an ode to those grammar hawks like Pamela and a lot of fun. Okay, let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, kick us off.
Mike, in today's Gadfly, you argue that the Obama administration's application of disparate impact theory to its school discipline enforcement policy is an enormous mistake. Can you elaborate?
It's a really, really big, enormous mistake. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, about that.
Okay, yeah. So here's the deal. So Dara, look, totally understand the point that there are schools out there that are not doing school discipline well, okay? They don't have a strong school culture. They resort to a lot of suspensions and even expulsions. And in some of these schools, you look at the numbers and it's mostly Black and Latino boys who are being expelled and suspended at high numbers. And so the Office of Civil Rights looks at this and says, we've got to do something about this. Certainly understand that there may be schools out there that are not doing this well, and that might even be discriminating. And it's the job of Office of Civil Rights to deal with that. Here's the problem. They've come out with this policy that said explicitly to administrators, okay, even if you have a policy that is race neutral and you apply it in a race neutral way, okay, there's no evidence that you're treating, in other words, African-American kids differently than white kids, you can still be found guilty of discrimination if it has a disparate impact. In other words, if you end up suspending more Black or Latino kids than white or Asian kids, I think that's nuts. What do you think?
So from a former teacher perspective, I had no idea what the discipline policy at my school was. I didn't even know how to discipline a student should that occur. I think that this is perhaps giving too much credit that there is actual thought put into these policies. I mean, at my school, discipline was handled by one person. It was the assistant principal. Yep. And
you're at a big high school.
I was at a large urban school. And beyond that, I had no idea how my school handled discipline. Suspension, in-house suspension, sent home. Search me.
Yeah.
And so I think in order for any discipline policy to work, you have to in order for any discipline policy to work, you have to acknowledge that most people have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, you mean that the teachers don't have a good strategy and that the schools don't have an actual plan. I mean, you go into some of these high-performing schools, including high-performing charter schools and some Catholic schools, and they do. They have a school-wide approach to these issues. And they say very explicitly, here's how we handle these things. Here's how we try to create a positive learning environment. They train the teachers on it. And the whole hope is to get to the point where you don't have to suspend kids or discipline kids because, you know, you're sweating the small stuff and you're making sure that these problems don't happen in the first place. But if they do happen, they have a plan for dealing with them, right? So I totally get it. We should help schools get much better at this than they are today. But some of those charter schools still end up from time to time suspending kids. And in my view, that's okay. That's important because you know what? It's not just about the kids who get suspended and what's the best way to handle their problems, maybe help them get back on the straight and narrow. It's also about all the other kids. And we know that disruptive students, one disruptive kid can have a hugely negative impact on student achievement if teachers feel like they have no option but to keep that kid in the class.
Right. So I think that ultimately I'm agreeing with you. But what I think is important is that you can't include something like disparate impact theory, saying that a discipline policy has a disparate impact when it implies that there is a discipline policy to begin with.
Gotcha. Very, very good. Okay, topic number two.
Also in today's Gadfly, Boston middle school teacher Peter Sipe argues that ed schools don't prepare teachers well enough for the classroom, illustrating his point by comparing his ed school experience with his wife's medical school experience. Should ed schools focus more on practical training, or should teachers continue to gain that with on-the-job experience?
Dara, this piece is just so aggravating. It's so well written. But he shows. I mean, his wife's in there cramming for exams, learning practical things like, I don't know, how to cut open bodies and stuff. And he's sitting around talking education theory for hours on end. Why are our ed schools seem so against teaching teachers practical stuff that might help them in the classroom?
Okay. You just said a lot there, Mike. And I will briefly say and not dwell on the fact that I highly disagree with the author.
Okay.
That training teachers and training doctors are two completely different things. Okay. So I'm going to put that aside for a second. Putting aside the faulty analogy here, the question that Pamela asked is, should ed schools focus more on practical training? And the fact is they do. Part of the traditional ed school preparation is a large amount of student teaching. Mm-hmm. What they are lacking, however, is meaningful feedback and reflexivity on that student teaching experience. Yeah. So I think saying that ed schools don't have any practical training is misleading. They do.
All right, that's fair. Student teaching. Yep.
But there's very little guidance, and especially the fact that you unleash a new teacher in a classroom with zero supervision, mm-hmm. there's another big failing, right? Yeah. That you assume that once you've given them this training, that they do have the practical skills and they have a once a year observation or maybe twice with a mm-hmm. new teacher mentor or something like that. But I think that really what is lacking here is meaningful practical preparation. Is there too much theory taught in ed schools? Probably, but saying that there is no practical knowledge is not entirely accurate, I think.
All right, but let me talk about my own experience. Many, many moons ago now, going through an ed school, University of Michigan, right? I did this on the side, had my political science degree, and then I got my teaching certification on the side. And yes, I did student teaching, so that was practical. Did not get a whole lot of great feedback from it. But otherwise, the courses I took, they were both super easy. I mean, everybody knew you were going to get an A without, you know, doing any work. It was totally different than my poli sci classes. But also, they were all theory. I mean, we sat around talking about Piaget. Fine. Okay. But then you pick up a book like the recent book by Doug Lemoff. And here he says, here's these practical things I'm going to teach you about how to be an effective teacher, how to stand in front of the room, what to do when the kids come in, how to make eye contact, how to ask questions, and ed schools by and large have said, no. We are not about that. That is vocational training. That is the kind of thing that might happen at one of those 2-year community colleges, right? We are part of academia. And as part of academia, what we do is we talk about, you know, we have a body of scholarship and we share that and we do research and we share that. All of which is to say, Well, fine. Then you know what? Maybe four-year colleges should not be training teachers because they seem to think it's below them to provide practical help for their teachers. Med schools don't seem to worry about this. I don't think law schools, business schools, most of these other professional schools seem to understand that part of their job is to help their graduates actually succeed on the job.
So I think in our N of two here, right, I think that your experience is not what we should be aiming for. And this idea that you can't include vocational training into teacher preparation is absurd.
Thank you.
My experience was different from yours. I went through an alternative certification program and half of my boot camp classes were theory and we learned about Piaget too.
Yep.
But the other half, literally one of our class assignments for our class was, what are you going to do on the first day of school?
Good.
Write a first year lesson plan.
Good.
Teaching icebreaker activities, teaching classroom management. So I did have some of that practical training in my experience. Interestingly, obviously, my theory classes were taught by university professors. My practical classes were taught by teachers.
Yep.
So.
No, that makes sense. Hey, by the way, can we get Piaget out of the curriculum? I mean, God, that guy just really annoys me. Or how about Paulo Freire, for God's sake? You didn't have Paulo Freire, did you?
I did have Freire. I liked Freire.
You liked Freire? Are you serious? He tried to run the schools down there in South America. It was a complete disaster.
But not until grad school.
All right. Pamela, topic number three.
During the Common Core transition, 21 states will continue to make students pass exit exams in order to graduate from high school, and 10 of these states will switch to tougher Common Core aligned tests. Anne Hyslop argues in a recent policy brief that unless states address the possible consequences, this could be a disaster. How should states handle this?
So, Dara, this is not going to be a disaster because I can't imagine any state is going to be dumb enough to say, hey, we're going to use a much tougher test and we're going to set these super high cut scores and we're not going to change our policies around graduation requirements at all. But Anne is right to say that states have to figure out a plan on how they're going to handle this transition.
Right. I mean, it's a big question, right? In California, for example, the KC, the exit exam, is aligned to the former state standards,
yep.
But they're aligned to it's aligned to the 10th grade standards. So
10th grade is generous. Usually these are at the 8th grade level, right?
So, right. No, I think that is an excellent point. We're not headed towards disaster. And obviously states have to think strategically about this, but they already did this the first time they implemented a high school exit exam. For example, in California, students take the CASE, the exit exam, in the 10th grade for the first time. They have up until the 12th grade to pass it. And it's already aligned with the state standards, just not necessarily at a 10th grade level.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been dealing with this question of high school exit exams aligned to state standards is not a new one, and it hasn't been disastrous yet.
All right. But what states will need to do most likely is they have to set two different passing scores, right? I mean, the whole promise of Common Core is to have a high cut score that meaningfully measures college and career readiness, right? So for, say, 11th graders or 12th graders, that you say, if you hit this score, we predict that you will be able to go take credit-bearing courses in college or get a decent-paying job, right? So you've got to make sure that is maintained. That should not be the level that you have to hit in order to graduate from high school, because we're pretty sure that the first few years, it's going to be something like a third of our kids who are hitting that level. And we are not going to flunk two-thirds of the kids and not give them high school diplomas. So that means you got to set a lower level as well. That indicates more some kind of basic literacy and numeracy. That is what should be tied to high school graduation.
No, I think I agree with you. And I'll also channel Checker for a moment here, which is to say that a smart exit exam system will also be used by the state university system.
Yep.
And instead of having an SAT or an ACT or something like that, that you have this test whose results can be applied more universally. Again, it's, do you get a diploma? Are you college and career ready? And for entrance into higher education system.
Well, now that's a tough one, I have to say. I mean, I don't think we're going to have much success in getting colleges to use it for their admissions necessarily, but there is a move to make them or encourage them to use it for placement. So they've got these other tests out there. They use Accuplacer and other things to decide if a kid ends up in remedial education. And the hope is to say, hey, if you pass the PARC or Smarter Balance at the college and career ready level, that should mean that you do not have to take a remedial course, end of story.
It was worth the plug.
It was worth the attempt, Dara, very nicely said. Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, Amber, Dara loves Weird Al, and I'm just wondering if you do too.
Dara does not.
Yes. I used to think he was pretty creepy. Still think he's kind of creepy.
Oh, yes. Just because he does look, he did the used to look, hair, maybe he still looks a little creepy.
Yeah, the hair and the lankiness. I don't know.
I'm not asking you to kiss the guy. I'm just saying, like, do you find his songs funny?
Oh, funny. I mean, I guess in some elementary school way, right?
Oh, ouch.
I just don't find him particularly entertaining, that's all.
Yeah. Does Nico find him entertaining, Mike?
I did have Nico watch Word Crimes, and yes, Nico thought it was very funny, especially the line about hitting the guy over the head with a sledgehammer or something like that.
Yes.
That stood out to Nico.
So, makes sense.
Fine. I guess I should. They always say, never ask a question you don't know the answer to. That's
yes,
what I get. All
right.
You and Dara, no sense of humor at all.
No, sorry.
All right. What you got for us this week,
Amber?
We got
a new report out from the Center for Reinventing Public Education called Making School Choice Work. It surveys 4,000 parents and interviews other civic leaders in 8 choice-rich cities: Baltimore, Cleveland, Denver, Detroit, Indy, New Orleans, Philly, Washington, D.C. The report's purpose was to help civic leaders in these cities help them improve their existing choice system, regardless of whether these parents have kids in charter or traditional schools. 3 key findings. 1, the majority of parents are actively choosing a school for their child, though they also report considering just 1 or 2 schools. Mm-hmm. So the natural question is, you know, how many options are there to begin with? And then on that question, about half report that if their current school was not available, there were no other schools that would satisfy them. Mm-hmm. 2, parents identify a number of barriers to choosing schools, including inadequate information, transportation, and a lack of quality options. Not understanding which schools their child is eligible to attend was the most often cited barrier. Hmm. And those challenges were not they were not unique to the charter or the district sector.
Yep.
And last, responsibility for schools often falls to multiple parties: school districts, charter school authorizers, state agencies, and so on and so forth. And too many cooks in the kitchen makes it difficult for parents to navigate information they found. So mm-hmm. we know this. Phoenix has 28 school districts. Houston has 19. So if you think about a charter operator trying to coordinate an enrollment timeline, for instance, and having mm-hmm. to negotiate agreements with all those districts would be a nightmare. So they give you some pragmatic examples of what these governance challenges are, you know, how they're impeding quality school choice. So in the end, they recommend that in some cases we need to change laws to ensure districts mm-hmm. and charter authorizers, you know, are working together. You know, maybe we need to address, you know, anyway, governance seemed to be the big thing that they ended up with, because you've just got a morass of different people with their hands in the pie and they cannot coordinate. And parents are confused in some cases. So anyway, I mean, I think some of this stuff we knew, but to have this information come out of the mouths of parents is exceedingly helpful.
Yeah, on that point about governance, you know, Robin Lake from SERPI has been writing about Detroit especially, though I think mm-hmm. this probably certainly applies to cities in Ohio, we know too, where you've got multiple authorizers, many of whom aren't there in the city. They're all mm-hmm. over the state of Michigan. And they may be authorizing schools that are not very good, right?
Right.
And there's nobody in charge, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nobody. And if somebody in Detroit, if the mayor's saying, hey, we've got to shut down these bad charter schools, he's out of luck. Well, there's nothing. He can't do it, right?
That's right.
And so on the one hand, you say, look, this is dynamic. There's a free market. You know, there's a lot of competition. On the other hand, it feels a little bit like the Wild West. And you know, when you've got a real quality problem, say, I don't know how to get our hands around this. It's a problem.
It's a problem.
Did they have any recommendations or observe any differences in cities that had a common application?
Not that I am aware of. The drill down they did was Denver. And what they're going to do, it's apparently a whole body of work. The next reports are going to drill down in each of these cities.
Yeah.
So I'm anticipating that they'll address that question in upcoming reports.
Yeah. Now, you would think that the common application mm-hmm. should help, and that's
yes.
something that's important. Look, SERPI does great work on mm-hmm. just getting these details right. That, you know, in my view, the big argument on school choice is over, right? I mean, I can't imagine
we see
that we're going to
need meaning.
Well, we're not going to go back to a day when parents parents don't have choices, right? Now the question is, how do we make the system work? As they said in the title here, how do we get the infrastructure? How do we deal with quality? How do we deal with these different trade-offs around flexibility and regulation? I mean, all of these things, which in some ways are very wonky and technical, but they're critical.
But I mean, isn't this striking that the key barrier from a parent's point of view is, can my kid go to that school? Yeah, are they allowed?
Sure.
You know, and how do I find out if they're allowed?
How do I find out? It's confusing.
That's the most basic question, right?
And so, you would think that great schools and some of these other, you know, folks that are focused on providing parent information, this should be fixable, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
we should be able to figure out a way to get good information to parents. There are some other problems that might be harder to deal with.
Right. So like a charter support organization, like here in D.C., the Focus, like a group like
that. Yeah, or something that's really focused on, parent-facing, you know, like a Great Schools that says, look, we are going to make sure that parents have a way, either online or in some kind of walk-in center, where they can get clear information on here are the choices. If you want something within a mile of your house, here's what you might look at. 3 miles, 5 miles.
That's right.
You know, and here's the best information we have in terms of whether these are quality choices. I mean, that should be doable at this point.
I agree. Like a central warehouse, right? So a parent's not like, okay, I've got to call the charter school up the road.
Yeah.
Or if you asked your district school, like, what are my options?
Right.
Not a huge incentive there to answer that question, which we've found out in previous research. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Thank you, Amber. That is all the time we've got for the Research Minute and for the Education Gadfly Show. So until next time,
I'm Darren Z. Handelar.
And I am Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.